Welcome to another episode of Capital Connection. As always, I'm your host, Matt Calder, and we're glad to have you on the show today. On today's show, if you've been paying attention to things that are going on in the state, you know that the Red for Ed Advocacy Day, or some people are calling it a teacher strike, happened on Wednesday of this week, on the first day of the legislative session, and there was, you know, about thousands of teachers marching from through downtown Raleigh to the legislature. There were meetings held with legislators. There was a rally afterward. Very big, very large event. And of course, Baird covering on nccapitalconnection.com, and also warranted a conversation with the Civitas Institute's Director of Policy, Dr. Bob Lupke, who is, of course, the education guru over at the Civitas Institute. It definitely Baird talking to him and getting into what, you know, his takeaways were from this event, and also the things that people, the teachers, are asking for, what their demands are, or some people are saying demands, some people are saying they need help, or there's just requests. I mean, there's a lot of different rhetoric surrounding this event, and we're going to have Bob Lupke in the office to really kind of delve down in and talk with us about those different nuances and different things, and just kind of his takeaways from the event. But, of course, before we get to that, I want to talk about subscribing to the show. If you're listening to the show on the airwaves, you know, on the radio stations over the weekends, then that's great, and we like that, but that's also not the easiest way for you to get the show to you to listen to. You have to be at a radio and be there at a certain time, and really, there's an easier way to do that, and the way to do it is to subscribe to the show through one of the many podcasting apps, whether you're an Apple user and it's Apple Podcasts, or whether you are an Android user, Podcast Addict is one. There's tons of others, and you can just go and you'll go into that app and search for Capital Connection and subscribe to the show, and you'll get it to your device without actually having to go out and hunt it down and search for it. And then also, though, there is the website, which, I mean, some of you who are, you know, not listening on the radio, but you're also not subscribed, you're listening, I'm sure, on the website, which is great for a lot of things. I think that subscribing to the show is easier because it gets the device to you without really a whole lot of effort from yourself. But definitely there are benefits to keeping the website around for where you're going to listen as well. And really the number one reason for that is that on the website you have the entire archive of the show going back for all of the episodes of Capital Connection, all of the episodes of What Matters in North Carolina, which is, of course, what the show was called beforehand. You've got everything there available for you, whereas in the podcasting app, you've only got a couple weeks worth of archives there for you. So there's definitely a good reason to go to the website, but also a good reason to go and subscribe if you're not already. Now, I also want to take a moment real quick to say that this show is sponsored by the Civitas Institute. That is North Carolina's conservative voice, and they sponsor this. They sponsor nccapitalconnection.com, the news-based website that I also work on. And without the Institute, none of these things would be possible for us to do each week. And again, that is in the Civitas Institute and North Carolina's conservative voice. And I also want to go ahead and push our social media for the show. And we're on Facebook, we're on Instagram, we're on Twitter. We're at NC CapCon on Facebook, or on Twitter and Instagram. And you can search Capital Connection on Facebook and you'll find us. You can search Capital Connection on all those apps and you'll run into our social media. And there you'll find a mix of things that go on the nccapitalconnection.com side. So the news articles and that stuff will be shared. These shows will be shared or are being shared on those three platforms. And again, that's nccapcon on Instagram and Twitter. You can follow us on Instagram and Twitter, or you can like our Facebook page, and that's Capital Connection or NC Capital Connection. So again, we're going to be talking with Dr. Bob Lupke. We're going to go into a number of things and really get a lot more context about this rally, about the things surrounding this rally. So without any further ado, we'll get to our segment with Dr. Robert Lupke. All right, Bob, thanks for coming back on the show.
It's good to be here, Matt.
So the big news in the state today is what we're going to talk about, or the big news yesterday, really, was the NCAE Day of Advocacy. And of course, you know, you're the Director of Policy for the Civitas Institute, but you're also the education guru for the Civitas Institute. And we're going to talk a little around what you saw out of the rally. Of course, I was out at the rally for nccapitalconnection.com, but you were out there for the Institute, and kind of talk a little around, you know, what we saw out there yesterday. Of course, for people who don't know, aren't familiar, there was a very large rally in March in the thousands from the North Carolina Association of Educators headquarters down to the legislature, marching for higher pay, marching for more school funding by, you know, a bunch of teachers, the Wear Red for Ed movement that's been going on across the nation and in some different states has made its way to North Carolina, and we saw that yesterday. So I guess my first question for you is, what was your first sort of hit from it? What did you kind of overall think of it?
Was there a rally yesterday? No, I say that obviously joking, because the rally was the biggest focus of attention for the press, the local press here, for actually the last several weeks. I think we were all a little bit surprised at the level of attention it got, but that's another story. But yes, Matt, I went down yesterday for a couple of reasons. We wanted to talk to teachers and see what they were thinking about, what motivated them to come to the rally, and just kind of observe what's going on with what we were told were about 15, 18,000 teachers coming to town, and what's on their minds. We had the chance to talk to a number of teachers, and what I found surprising was what they were saying. We were asking them what motivated them to come, and I only heard pay from one teacher, and we probably talked to about 10 or 11. That was not the first thing out of their mouth, and that I thought was surprising, considering what you've been hearing from NCAE incessantly for the last 5-6 years. Anybody who's been watching this issue knows that teachers have gotten 4 consecutive raises, and with the announcement this past week that the legislature is planning on providing a 6.2% pay increase for teachers, we'll know that that's the 5th consecutive raise. So I think that issue is, you know, is hopefully falling to the wayside, because a lot of money's been thrown at it, and I think it's not a big a topic with teachers as the leadership is saying it is. So that's one takeaway. The other one is that it seems what's been on teachers' minds, at least from the people that we heard, and I talked to probably about a dozen teachers yesterday about their concerns. And it wasn't any one thing. Some of it was they wish they had teacher assistants back in their rooms. Some of it was funding for books, textbooks, or digital materials. Some of it had to do with relationships between DPI and the state legislature. It dealt with a lot of process issues and issues that, in my view, could be handled more at the local level if some flexibility was given. And I was actually kind of encouraged, because they all seemed, they being the issues, they all seemed to be things that I think if people sat down and talked about, they were all tweakable. Our hope is, and I think most Republicans, since Republicans have gained majorities in the legislature since 2011, and when I say that, I mean, I'm talking primarily conservatives. Since that's been the case, our hope has been to transfer more authority and more decision-making power back to the local districts, because we feel that they have more expertise and more knowledge about how to solve problems in their individual schools. So I think if we can make more progress in doing that, some of these things that I've heard mentioned yesterday, we could make some headway on.
Right, and some of that reflects what I heard yesterday as well, with the want for more funding, and they wanted you're concerned about buying their own supplies, or concerns about the buildings. And one guy I talked to, the roof needed to be fixed for a long time, and it wasn't for a few years until the funding came through for it and that sort of thing. So it seems like facilities were on people's minds. But I did hear a lot of people talking about the pay, and some talking about insurance premiums and how the premiums have gone up from $15 to $50, or how the copays are higher than they used to be and that sort of thing. So there was talk about that, but that was really the minority. It was really the pay and the school funding that you're talking about that came up a lot.
Yeah, it's interesting because, as I said before, I asked people, I tried to ask people what motivated them to come, and I did not hear two of the same answers. I mean, there wasn't any overriding theme. It seemed like it was different things with different people. And that's not right or wrong. It's just that there were a lot of different things that were out there, and not just, pay concerns that were dominating the entire rally. We did hear that did come into the discussion, but it didn't seem to be the overwhelming major issue that you hear in the media.
Right, and I had one teacher I talked to that really reflected that. They said something to the effect of, if our pay was maybe a little bit lower, but we had the, adequate funding, maybe we would, maybe we would just be kind of grumbling about it, but we wouldn't be here, was sort of the sentiment.
Yes, and that's interesting, because when pay did come up, we tried to get a sense of, if pay wasn't adequate, what would be a fair salary for teachers in a particular area. And much to my dismay, no answer was given, which I think, it usually was a result of coaching from, people you can expect were coached by. But we probably asked that question three times when we had the opportunity. When people were talking about inadequate pay, we did ask what would constitute, a fair salary. And people were kind of hesitant, to answer that question, which is frustrating, because I'm sure, in order to really address the issue, and if legislators want to obviously address the issue, you have to ask that question, and there has to be an answer to it. No. But when one's not offered, just frustration sets in.
I mean, I wouldn't mind for my boss to ask me what I think would be adequate pay. I think I could come up with a pretty quick answer. I don't know about you. You say, well, Matt, what do you think is would be adequate pay? What pay would make you happy right now? I think I'll come back with something.
The answer is always more.
Oh, it's more, but I can give it a real number. I can make that leap. But I ran into that same thing where I said, okay. Actually, I ran into somebody who said to me at first, we've had no pay raises for years. Which I knew wasn't the case. I knew the last 4 years. I knew about that. So I asked her, I said, well, in the last 4 years, there have been pay increases. And she said, oh, well, it was never enough to meet the cost of living increase. But I know that in itself wasn't true either. I mean, what's the cost of living go up per year versus, what is this 19.1% average increase?
Well, the actual cost of consumer price index last year was 2.1% inflation.
Right, yeah. and the average of the raise was much higher than that. But moving beyond that,
average teacher salary increase last year was 3.3%. So, just to be accurate.
Right. So I mean, that's definitely over the cost of living, but And then I asked, you said, okay, well what's the, you know, what's the right amount? What's the raise? What do you need? I mean, and these people are telling me about how they're working like a Friday, Saturday, Sunday night job, or they're working to another job or a third job to make ends meet. And then I ask about how much do you want? What are you asking for? And I ran into that same issue. There wasn't an answer. There was not a, well, this is what we want to be paid. This is what we need to be paid to really be getting what we, you know, what we deserve or what we need. And that is frustrating. But my other frustration is I look at the pay scale and I see the number, like a starting teacher, and that job is $7,000 a year more than my first job out of college. So that's part of my frustration when I'm looking at all this. You talk about not being paid enough. I'm going, okay, well, and then they also talk about how it's not a 9-to-5 job. It's not a, people say, oh, you work 8-to-4, you get off, and it's not, and then you're done. My first job was in a newspaper in Goldsboro, North Carolina, making $27,000 a year, going to you know, all these committee meetings, going to city council meetings, going to all these events. I was working around the clock. I rolled out of bed at 2 in the morning because somebody ran a car into a light pole and the power went out and I had to write a story on it. And I was doing it for $27,000 a year. I would have loved to have done it for $35,000 a year.
Well, I think this is part of living in a country that offers us a lot of choices, is it not? Most of our first jobs we take to get our foot in the door.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they're not perfect. We all wish we probably had more money, but we have our foot in the door. It provides an opportunity, you know, to be with an organization, to audition, so to speak, and, you know, improve ourselves, learn about the opportunity and contribute. And if we do well, we're on our way. If we're not a good fit, we usually move on into something else. And that's no different in education. I mean, the lowest paying jobs in education are lower grade teaching jobs usually. It's no different than anywhere else. And there has been progress. Obviously, the legislature in the last 4 or 5 years, I think in 2014, Governor McCrory took the initiative on improving starting teaching salaries and boosted that to $35,000. That was the most pressing need. There's an understanding amongst everyone working on this issue that there still needs more work to be done. But that was the first real effort to address it. And now we are starting to tweak, so to speak, some of the things that have come up, like with adjustments to principal pay that were a result of raises that they gave to the other people in the last couple of years. Some abnormalities came up where people that were working fewer years were actually making more than people that had greater experience. So they've made adjustment for that. But one of the things that I also found interesting about yesterday is when we were talking about teacher pay, I was talking to a gentleman who had actually been a teacher for about 15 years. He had worked up at a charter school in Washington, D.C., but then had worked at a school in Durham for probably about another 10 years or so. And we were talking about a lot of issues, but pay came up. And I had asked him, to comment on legislative efforts, you know, to give, at least to tie pay to performance. And he was familiar with it. And I said that there were a lot of people in the legislature that ultimately thought that the best way to pay teachers was to give local principals or local officials more flexibility in how to pay teachers. In other words, like in a normal business, your boss or the head of the organization's really have more knowledge about your job performance than anyone else. And if you're being paid by conditions that are somewhat external to your actual job performance, that's not good for anyone. So there's been a considerable effort to try to push those decisions down to a local level. And his response to that was, you know, conceptually, he would be in agreement with it, but there are always instances where, well, he said some principal would not like somebody and doesn't feel like they'd be treated fairly, et cetera. Anecdotal evidence, you know, always comes up. But I asked him, you know, no system's going to be perfect, but would you, if you were given a choice between the current system and, you know, moving more towards a system that provided pay based on having local officials have more of those responsibilities, he favored the latter. And I found that surprising. But because NCAE's position has always been, you know, they're strongly opposed to moving anything away from the teacher pay schedule. But there's so many inequities in that. And I believe, and this is a whole other discussion, but that's the number one impediment to really raising teacher pay is the teacher salary schedule.
Right, and I mean, that would be, well, I heard some comments yesterday about, you know, this isn't how business does things, or this is, you know, they do in business, they do signing bonuses and this and this and this, and things are competitive. And you know, teaching is the only field you don't get paid more now in North Carolina for having an advanced degree when they used to have the pay for masters. And there was all these correlations to business and the way that things there work. And that's in that vein. Go, okay, if you want to be more like the business world, then you're going to be negotiating for your own salary. You're going to be, you know, there's going to be a lot more local power when it comes to how much you make, instead of getting into something that is set and decided and you know what to expect. There's going to be some ambiguity there, and you're going to have to fight for what you want to get paid.
Yeah, and I think ultimately teachers want that accountability. They know who the good teachers are. They know the teachers that aren't so good. And I remember when this issue first burst forth onto the scene in the most recent iteration, which was about 2011-2012. And I wrote an article where I suggested, you know, just sacking the teacher salary schedule. You know, and there was discussion at the time, and there were a number of people that were saying the same. But I laid out my reasons, and I got a lot of email from teachers, you know, opposing the idea vehemently, and a number of them called me up. And that was really an interesting experience from my perspective, because by the time I talked to a number of them on the phone, and I explained my rationale, and you know, there were some misunderstandings that came up from the paper, but I still think to this day that most teachers want a better system. The problem with the current system is that it provides no incentives to excellence. Now, it pays based on experience, but on the front end, and even when there was the initial discussions on starting pay for teachers, one of the biggest problems with the current system was, and they've tried to correct this, is that it took too long for teachers to get up to, you know, a living wage or a median income. Like, for example, if you're talking about business, if you're in business or if you're an attorney or a doctor, you can be up to a fairly good salary within 10 years. You know, in teaching, it took way too long. In other words, the slope of the teacher salary schedule was not very high. Your salary on an annual basis was not going up very much. And so what was happening is people were graduating from education schools, and, you know, a year or two in, they saw the handwriting on the wall and said, it's going to take me forever, you know, to make any money. So they left in droves, and there was, you know, a statistic floating around that nationally, 50% of teachers that were graduating from ed schools were out of the field within 5 years. And that got people's attention, and then the same was going on here as with comparable numbers in North Carolina. So what that prompted the legislature to do was to adjust upward, you know, starting salaries, and also to give teachers higher annual raises so that, you know, there'd be more of an incentive to stay in the field and just deal with practical reality of living, you know, which, you know, young people have, you know, we all struggle with that, but the pay increases that were added in recent years, you know, were an attempt to rectify some of that. So that was good. That was good. But still, within the salary structure, the salary schedule framework, I would advocate still getting rid of that and going more to an individual basis where principals or school boards or some entity, some local entity, would have more say on setting individual salaries. Now, people say you'd have to start from scratch. Well, that's true, but there's plenty of experience of school districts doing that, and I don't believe it would have the, you know, difficulty. You know, it wouldn't have the difficulty that most people ascribe to it. It could be done. It could be done successfully. And I think teachers in the long run would be much happier, and they'd have more incentives built into the system, and it would result in just a better teaching faculty.
Yeah, and I tend to agree. I think there's a certain sense of security that teachers feel now from having the pay scale that they would be giving up to do that. But I think if you're doing it in a way that gives local control, more local control to their administrators, that would make sense. Because it's very hard to standardize in the teaching area, to standardize what success is, to measures of success. Because let's say your test scores go down. Could it be that you really just have a less capable class that year than the year before? I mean, it's kind of hard to standardize what makes a great teacher from Raleigh. But for a principal to look at his teachers that he sees every day, or, you know, and knows how hard they're working, knows how good they are, you know, shadows them in the classroom, to give them the power to have more say over their salary is a better maybe way of doing it, and is more comfortable for the teachers, as opposed to someone in, you know, getting rid of the pay scale and having someone in Raleigh trying to standardize a system of success or measuring success of teachers.
I couldn't agree with you more, Matt. The sheer exercise of having the responsibility at a local level would force districts to say, how are we going to do this? How are we going to pay teachers? How are we going to differentiate between really great teachers, you know, good teachers, you know, adequate teachers? And the act of doing that is going to force an exercise, you know, where that's going to be beneficial not only for the leadership there, but also for the faculty. And they'll be able to work their way through it. It will not be perfect, but because we don't have a perfect system doesn't mean that we should keep something that's horrifically bad.
Right. And so the last thing I want to get into is I was out there taking a bunch of pictures yesterday from their march, and I want to talk about a few of the signs that I saw and see what you think of these signs. And I took pictures of a ton of people, and there's some signs that I think have good messages, some that are funny, some props that were used. There's a toilet seat that someone used. I can't tell what they wrote on it. But it seems pretty interesting.
So we're going to talk about signs, and we're going to talk about it on radio, huh, man?
Yes. I'm going to describe the signs. I'm just going to say what the signs say. We've got we'll start off, we got a Bob Ross sign, you know, the painter from TV. And his
with
sign.
With the distinctive hairstyle.
Yes, the beard and the afro. And it says, no mistakes, we need a happy little budget. You know, this Bob Ross, there's no mistakes, just happy accidents, happy trees. I know you remember Bob Ross.
Yes, I do remember Bob Ross. I remember watching his painting show with my children for hours and hours when he had it.
It was mesmerizing, yes. Wasn't it, watching him go?
And he would complete masterpieces within a half hour, you know, and he mesmerized millions of people in doing that. But, you know, the sign in his honor probably probably made a lot of people smile.
Probably. I also like this one. It says, I'm 44 years old and my mom still buys my school supplies. It's clever.
Yeah, it's clever, but people smirk on that, but I kind of shake my head because there's this sentiment out there that the state budget is cutting school supplies, and we really need the proper context when we talk about school supplies, because what happened a few years ago is the state gave local districts greater flexibility in using money for school supplies. And so they could choose from a number of different pots of money. But also that has to be balanced with the reality that and you said school supplies, but I assume that we're probably talking a little bit about textbooks, too.
Probably, yes.
Okay, because the reality is that digital textbooks are kind of like the default book now, if you will, that more money is being spent on digital materials than textbooks, and some of that's a local option, some of it's a statewide option. So, but that's the reality. And when people talk about less money being spent, some of it's just a function of that trend, and that there has been great impetus from the state level to move districts, you know, towards that. The rationale given, I don't necessarily always agree with it. In fact, I don't agree with it, is that in the long run, it will be cheaper and kids enjoy it more. From the perspective that it's more economical, I don't agree with that, because there are always maintenance costs. There are licensing costs, there are updates and all that stuff that really tend to eat away at any savings that people say that would accrue. So that's an argument that I think can, you know, be, you know, taken from both sides.
All right. And then we have 35 is a speed limit, not a class size.
Well, that's an interesting sign. I have, you know, my grade school had an average class size of 40.
Oof.
And I mean, obviously this was years ago, but my response to that is, let local districts decide that. Let principals decide. They know how teachers can manage. They know how teachers can teach. And people are fearful that, well, if you give those decisions to local officials, you'll have classrooms of 70 or 75. No, you will not. You will not, for a lot of reasons. There'll be a happy medium that schools will arrive at, because they know what works and what doesn't. And what gets me all the time is, we say teachers are different, and we say kids are different. Well, then why do we try to standardize everything with these rules and say every classroom will have, you know, 21 students or 30 students or 18 students, when we know that, you know, there are circumstances where, you know, teachers could very well do better with more students or better with less or fewer. And why not let that be a decision that local schools can decide? They know better than Raleigh in most all these situations. And I think we ought to trust them more.
All right. And I've got another one here that, of course, you know, there has to be at least one sign with a grammatical mistake. There's irony there. They're teachers. You know, a lot of them are teachers holding these signs. This one says, "You're better than this." Y-O-U-R.
I don't know if I can add anything to that.
Oh, I don't know if you need to, but I just want that out there that there is a "You're better than this" sign. And then, so there's also been questions going around about whether or not it's a strike or not. And this sign, so there was a sign that said strike on it, at least one, but this sign says "more pay, less delay." That seems to speak to the mindset of stopping work, stopping schools from going forward. If you give us more pay, there'll be less delay. There'll be less delay on teaching. I mean, am I reading into that right, do you think?
Yeah, I do. In fact, it's interesting you brought that up because I had a comment from a teacher that I was taken aback by a little bit yesterday that had kind of inferred the same things, that they came here knowing that they had to make a statement, and that statement had to, in a sense, hurt in the sense of, you know, closing schools down so that they would send a message to the legislature and the general public that you know, they're serious about this, and if there has to be some pinching, you know, in the process, they're willing to do it. The whole question of is this a strike, you know, is something that we explored earlier in the week, and not to get into the great details of it, but North Carolina state statutes defines strike very expansively. It refers just to a work stoppage or cessation of duties. And you can make a strong argument that what teachers have done constitutes a strike, because there has been a slowdown and a cessation of duties that were a result of direct actions of teachers.
All right, I've got three signs I want to run by you in this group, okay? We've got the one saying that in North Carolina we spend $6,115 per student annually and $35,252 per inmate. So that's the first sign. Then we have a second sign that says we spend $8,615 per student and $35,252 per prisoner, per inmate. And then we have another sign that says we spend, where is this one? I'm running through my pictures here. Here we go. This spends $9,528 per student and $35,252 per inmate. Here's my first question. Why is it the same for inmates every time, but all three signs are different for per pupil spending?
I think we should spend more on statistics classes. You know? Well, actually, sadly, I know what they're referring to. Obviously, the cost of education, how they define it, which I take issue with, versus the cost of what we're spending to house inmates. The variation on figures results from how they define spending. The $6,100-some is their reference to state spending, the state portion of per pupil spending. Now, what's wrong with that is it does not involve federal or local funding. If you take that money, it rises to about $9,200. In 2017. Now, that figure, which is thrown around, does not include capital costs, which, you know, are the costs to build schools.
Which is probably included in the inmate cost. And the fact that they're housing them 365, you know, every day, 24/7, 365.
Yeah, your cost, it's not an apples to apples comparison. You could...
No pun intended, because teachers, apples.
No pun intended. No pun intended. So, I mean, the point they're trying to make, obviously, is one of, you know, priorities, et cetera. But, you know, it's an issue that people need to deal with in the long run as far as how much we're going to spend on each. But it's always helpful to use accurate figures.
Right. And it's just funny to me that there's not a standardized number that kind of came out of this, but the number for the prisons is very standardized. And then, so another one, you mentioned teacher assistants and how some people wanted more teacher assistants. There's a sign here, how many teacher assistants have we lost since 2008? And it says, try over 7,500.
Well, that may be the case, but my response to that is local districts can also fund. They're given money to fund. They can use money to fund teacher assistants if they want to. So some of that's I'm not going to deny that some of the money that was set aside for teacher assistants has been reduced. But local districts still have the option to hire teaching assistants if they want to. So to put that entirely on state government is something that's unwarranted.
All right, and my last sign is going to be my favorite sign. It says, if Harry Potter can find the Sorcerer's Stone, then you can find funding for education.
Well, I think we have found a lot of funding for education. In the last year, we spent $13.1 billion on education. I think we can all agree resources are important, but they aren't the be-all, end-all for everything. And I think good teachers are important. That is probably one of the most important things to get in our classrooms are good teachers. So that's the focus, I think, what the legislature wants to do. And, you know, I think during the process of making that happen, we've had a number of really strong raises in the last few years. But there are other things to do that don't involve money. And, you know, those are going to be coming up. They've come up in the last couple of years. But money, as it is with all things, I mean, it's not the be-all, end-all. And that's one of the things we have to realize with education. It's important, but oftentimes, you know, it's the beginning of a process, not the whole process.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us on Capital Connection.
Thank you, Matt.
All right. Thank you to Bob for coming on the show. We definitely appreciate you coming back and really digging down and sharing with us your opinions on some of these things surrounding the march. So thank you to you, the listeners. And again, I've said it before, I'll say it again. I hope that today you feel more connected to your capital. We are, of course, Capital Connection, and we want to be that connection for you to the capital. Thank you for joining us on Capital Connection, and we'll catch you next time.